Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This summer, 25 young African leaders have been attending a summer institute on civic leadership at the University of Delaware, part of the U.S. State Department program called the Mandela Washington Fellowship. The fellows are from various African countries, specializing in different areas, including media, law, and healthcare. A few Mandela fellows recently sat down with our Megan Pauly to discuss topics like media censorship and accessibility they're working to address in their home countries. Vicenzia is a lawyer, media expert, and activist in Tanzania. Brighton is an environmentalist and youth empowerment expert in Zambia. And Tanay is a human rights lawyer in Zimbabwe. Here's their conversation.
Thank you all for being here. I just want to have you go around and introduce yourselves.
My name is Brighton Kauma. I'm an environmentalist, and I'm also a communications trainer from Zambia.
Hi, my name is Vincenzia. I'm from Tanzania. I'm a media development expert and also a lawyer.
Tanay Mukwewa from Zimbabwe. I'm a human rights lawyer.
Just want to touch base on, for those lawyers here, legal experts, what issues you're grappling with right now in your native countries and how you see the media playing a role with those issues?
As for me, I promote also freedom of speech and media independence and access to information. These are basic human rights. And what I do, connecting with the media, because media plays a vital role in bridging the gap between the authorities, but also the people. So I've seen some sort of shrinking space in Tanzania in terms of freedom of speech. And therefore, I design programs that to promote freedom of speech, but also engage journalists to use their role as gatekeepers or watchdogs to reach to people, but also promote accountability.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on the shrinking space in terms of freedom of speech?
Yeah, in 2 years ago, Tanzania enacted two laws. One is called Cybercrime Law, and another one is the Statistics Act. So, you know, for journalists, statistics is very important. And now we are also focusing on data. But no one is allowed to produce any data without getting access or permission from the National Bureau of Statistics. On one hand, as a promoter of freedom of expression or media independence, I think that's a setback. But also, we enacted, as I said, cybercrime law, which actually criminalizes a lot of activities that are being done online. So sharing of information, and also, you know, journalists depend on tips to follow up on a story. But these days, if you are caught holding certain tips or sharing certain tips, that may lead you to criminal issues. So that's why I say the space is kind of shrinking.
Well, in Zimbabwe, we have what is called the Access to Information Protection of Privacy Act, which is viewed as draconian. So what it does is that it criminalizes a lot of journalism work. It makes journalists to expose their sources, and from IPA, we also have also the Broadcasting Services Act, which gives the power to the government to regulate who can get a practicing license as a broadcaster. So we have one national broadcaster, we have one TV station with a country of 13 million people, we have four radio stations that are owned by the state, we have what are called private players, but the private players belong to one political party. Interestingly, we are probably one of the only countries that uses an international radio station, which is the Voice of America, as the easiest and most credible source of information. And we have too many what are called clawback clauses. despite the fact that the government gives so many rights, we have a very expansive, beautiful constitution that guarantees freedom of information, that guarantees freedom of the media. But they always have clawback clauses. So they give with one hand and take them with the left hand. So you would find, for example, access to information is a cardinal right in the Zimbabwean constitution. But there's always a however. However, a state security, information that is viewed to be not in the interest of the state, you are not allowed to pass. So who is the determinant? There are no determining factors. Simple statistical data, like the census. People would want to know the ethnographics of Zimbabwe. In order for you to write about the ethnographics in Zimbabwe, you write to the office of the president. And the office of the president are the ones that can allow you to use that data, or they can deny you to use that data. So on its own, one can actually see you have rights, but those rights, you cannot use them.
So do you defend journalists in your work and in their trying to get access to information?
I have actually assisted a number of journalists who have been arrested in their line of duty. An example is one gentleman called Crispin Ndlovu. Crispin Ndlovu was arrested as he was taking photos of police brutality. The police were beating up an unarmed demonstrator who was not violent, a human rights defender. And Chris happens to have taken a photo, and he was arrested for it. He was taken to prison, and he was denied medical assistance. And we had to chip in as human rights lawyers to say that he has a right to medical assistance. And so on a number of occasions, we have assisted mostly photojournalists. The print journalist can hide in the comfort of another building and tell their story. But the photojournalist has to be on the scene to get the story. And so they have been found in the line of duty. And interestingly, even independent, even government journalists have been beaten up in opposition party. So this opposition party rallies. So in essence, we have a duty to even protect journalists from the state, and also from other political actors, because there's a culture of violence that is permeating from the state, and it's also going to the opposition and the ruling elite.
What about radio? Is radio widely used in Zimbabwe?
We have what are called urban and rural divide. So in the urban areas, people predominantly use television, they use social media. But in the rural, people use radio. So if you want to be able to communicate anything to the rural population, which happens to be more than 70% of the population, one has to be able to use radio. It would be of interest to even know that in Zimbabwe, we announce deaths over the radio. If you want to inform your relative that someone has passed away, the easier way for them to get the message would be, and quicker and credible, is over the radio. If you were to send a text message, even of a flood alert, chances of people taking it seriously are slim. But when it's announced on radio, there are higher chances that people will be on high alert.
And Brighton, is that the case in Zambia as well, with the radio kind of bridging the gap for those maybe living in rural areas?
Yeah, and primarily you realize that, like Tinei described earlier, we've got about more than 70% of the Zambian population that have got access to radio. And radio is viewed primarily as a source of not only information but entertainment as well. So you realize that sometimes when people that live in villages want to access information about when to plant, or the coming of a flood, or the announcement of a funeral, or the announcement of when they need to begin harvesting, they always turn the radio on to wait for the announcer to say, to give them information on that particular area. But one interesting thing is that radio is also a medium that is very inexpensive in Zambia, because just by having access to a small mobile phone that doesn't have access to internet, but it's got access to radio, you'll be able to tune in and get the news and get timely information about whatever you want. The other interesting part is that it's very accessible. It reaches a huge demographic compared to TV, which other people might also find interesting. But the other interesting thing that I've also seen in my area of radio and working with children is that radio is fun, you know. It's fun for children, and children are also fun for radio. And we try to use radio as a medium, as an intimate medium of voices, to educate communities using peer-to-peer information transfer, as well as intergenerational engagement between children and the adults. So primarily, I find radio to be a very, very, very strong tool, not only in disseminating information about the environment, but also in terms of disseminating information and advocating for certain political paradigm shifts. We've used radio during campaigns. People have used radio to advance particular policies and regulations. People have also used radio to remove certain individuals that we are not using resources prudently according to best practices. So radio has been used in a wide array of ways, and it still happens to be one of the strongest mediums that is, one, inexpensive, accessible, easy to use, fun, and cheap.
In terms of radio being very intimate, do you feel that other sources and people are more open and willing to share their stories, and with the risk of censorship over the radio as opposed to on TV or in a print medium?
Well, I think radio gives you quite a number of opportunities for you to, one, as an individual, protect your identity, as opposed to TV, because on TV sometimes they might blare certain aspects of your physical well-being to protect your own well-being as an individual. But again, radio really gives you an opportunity for you as an individual, first of all, to protect your confidentiality and uphold to your rights to confidentiality. But apart from that, it also gives you an opportunity as an individual to share your voice without being identified. So that gives you a lot of trust in that form of communication. I think the other thing is that there are quite a number of disparities. Like Tine described earlier, there are government-owned radio stations, there are private-owned radio stations, and there are also faith-owned radio stations. So in Zambia, there are Catholic-owned radio stations, or Baptist-owned radio station, or Protestant-owned radio stations. As you may be aware, Zambia is among the biggest Christian nations in Africa. So you realize that the church really invests a lot of money in things like radio stations and communication and the press. But again, the government also has its own radio station. And you realize that there are quite a number of disparities in terms of how information is disseminated. Government will always try to ensure that it protects and advances its own aspirations and goals and manifestos by broadcasting information that is inclined towards what it wants to communicate. The church will also do likewise. The independent media will, to a large extent, try to create that steady balance. Although I feel they trade on a very thin ice because of quite a number of regulations and policies that protect how information is disseminated. But the other thing that I also need to indicate is that there's a lot of freedom in terms of what is communicated and what is consumed. But of course, we've had incidents where certain media houses were closed because they were not pro-government, or certain media houses were rescinded from operating because they were not advancing what particular interest groups wanted. So there are always these number of variables around access to information and
sure. And so tell me a little bit more about your work with young people and how you address this censorship and the training with them. How do you engage with them and encourage them to become journalists in the media landscape?
When I was very young, when I was a kid, I understand I'm still young, but when I was a kid, I was running a radio show at one of the Catholic radio stations that was primarily centered towards educating the community on the effects, the brunt consequences of climate change and environmental pollution, having born and grown up in a peri-urban community that was faced with myriad challenges of pollution from the mines. So I had a lot of interest and enthusiasm and passion in radio at a very tender age. And later on, I co-established an organization. And that was because another organization that deals in radio from Cape Town trained me in broadcasting. It's called the Children's Radio Foundation. It's got offices in New York, Cape Town, and Oxford in the United Kingdom. So it's because of having been mentored and given such opportunities that my friends and I thought of creating another platform that can give a voice to other young people. So we go in schools, identify young people who are interested in radio, and we've created a radio curriculum. So we train them in, first of all, ethical reporting. So we ensure that they report ethically and are very credible in terms of sourcing, citing the sources of information that they're disseminating on radio. And the other thing that we teach them is community organizing, because we don't just want them to be going on radio and not really leading by example. So we give them the tools and skills to organize themselves in communities, to carry out outreach events, to also plant trees, or just do general sensitization. Apart from that, in our three-day radio workshop, we also train kids on how to speak with confidence, how to express themselves, how to ask the right questions. And we also give them skills on how to produce different radio formats, because we realize that sometimes it becomes monotonous for kids to go on radio and just do normal interviews. So we teach them how to produce public service announcements on that particular topic they're discussing. We teach them how to debate on radio. We teach them how to also create vox pops. So they get the views of the people by going in communities to get opinions on that particular topic. We also teach them how to produce jingles. And everything they do is edit-free. We give them portable sound recorders and we encourage them to produce edit-free documentaries. So with time, we've realized that by giving them opportunities to go in the communities, they become more emotionally intelligent, they become more assertive, and they become more responsive to the needs of their communities. And in the end, they're growing up to be more ethical young leaders, all-rounded young people that are now changing the narrative about their communities. And one interesting thing that I need to indicate is that we also give them opportunities together with our partners, the Children's Radio Foundation. So we send kids to huge conferences. Last year in July, we sent about four young people to Durban, and we arranged an interview with Prince Harry and Sir Elton John. So we try to expose them to life-changing opportunities by having them engage with the world's thought leaders, for them to realize that there is more to what they see in their communities. And if they're exposed to such opportunities, they can grow up inclined towards wanting to be ethical young leaders.
For you, Brightner Vicenzia, do you feel like access for women to become journalists, there's a gap between the access for men and women?
Well, I work with the Tanzania Media Foundation, and our work is basically to strengthen the media for accountability. And we give grants, and also we give learning components depending on how we feel there's a need from the journalists, from the media houses, but also the way we think the country or the world is going. So I design programs such as fellowships. These are specialized programs for 6 months. And in these programs, usually most of the applications are for men and not from women, and in other programs as well. So some are very rigorous programs, but some are a bit easy program where we get more junior journalists. So a number of women tend to go for the simpler programs. To me, this was a challenge, getting women participating in programs. To address that, I had to change some strategies, including visiting the media houses and try to engage with editors on how to, like, we could do some sort of co-designing or co-programming so that we get a number of women journalists participating. But then another approach is headhunting, approaching the female journalists. Because sometimes when they see the applications online, because usually we send the application online, they just by reading they fear to apply. But when I engage them into discussions, they say, so I can apply. And we support them in also organizing the applications and stuff. Or if I find some of them, most of them have applied for simpler programs, I also engage them into discussions whether they could also consider into regress programs. And it has been helpful.
What are some of the other barriers that women face, maybe even in their own newsrooms?
I think it's tough working in the media houses, and especially for women. First of all, the journalism as a course in the universities came very late in Tanzania. Many people would go for just colleges and stuff. And we had other courses like law, for instance, have been there for many years, I think, since we got in, even before we got independence in 1961. So we have a lot of lawyers, like, specialized in a number of fields. But for journalists, most of them are from the small colleges and stuff. So they don't have the same sense of capacity or confidence to see opportunities and try to grab them. Because with all these shrinking space that I've been talking about, we need our journalists to be also to report fairly, use all ethics, as Brighton has said, and also to use correct data and stuff, you know, the issue of fake news. So it's important that we take them through a rigorous program, which they usually don't get from other colleges.
You've also worked, I think you said, mentioned with women who've been sexually abused or been in the newsroom, kind of there've been some misconduct between male coworkers and the women.
Oh, in the past we used to have a lot of issues, not only with the media, but also in like we used to say sexual corruption. Like, unless you use your body, you will not get a job. So it was also very common in media houses. So program like the ones that I'm designing at the Tanzania Media Foundation will give the journalists, especially female journalists, another angle to look at things, to also be confident about their profession and also confident to like explore other opportunities, but also to report these incidences when they happen. Because oftentimes, most of the female journalists feel that they don't have options. They still need to get to pay bills. And it's worse if you have irresponsible man in the house because they don't leave anything, but they expect to find something on the table. So this is also common these days.
Would anyone care to elaborate a little bit more on civil rights, human rights issues that you're dealing with in your countries and how that work overlaps with what you're doing while you're in the U.S. and or what you've learned while you've been here and what you hope to take back home?
One of the key things that I've sought to try and find out just while I'm in the States is how do you create an empowered citizenry? A citizenry that knows their rights, a citizenry that can be able to demand their rights. When we watch American movies, everyone can simply say, I have the right to remain silent, anything. Or people would say, I'll invoke the fifth. You know, it's almost like cliche. How do you make certain things to become cliche? So it means that a citizenry is empowered. So that's one of the key takes that I've been able to take in the U.S., how to invest in an empowered citizenry that is able to demand from the state, that is able to also negotiate a social contract with the state. So it's been an important journey, and also to learn best practice. And also identifying key institutions to protect and promote democracy, how they work in the U.S., and not necessarily that we want to transplant them in Africa, But to be able to have a basis for creating something that can work in Africa. And out of interest, I found it very amusing that in the States, radio stations are not protected by the army. Probably, I don't know about Tanzania, but I know certainly that in Zimbabwe, for example, if you want to do a coup in Zimbabwe, you take over a radio station. And so you realize that the radio stations in Zimbabwe are protected by the army. So it shows the power that a radio station has in terms of credibility. And also the state is so afraid of radio. And that's an important take. How can we make radio accessible to communities? And how can we make the state not to think of radio as the evil institution? For me, community radio stations are the key, and they have a different voice altogether. What happens in Delaware is best explained by people in Delaware. And in the communities that I come from, people have community radio stations, but the community radio stations, they can't broadcast. So usually what they do is there are institutions that come and record, and they do pre-recordings. And we still do it the old school way, put it in a cassette and go and distribute, or put it in a CD, go and distribute, or also pre-record and send over the phone. But however, government regulations still stipulate that you can't broadcast. So they usually, as we are going towards elections, there are higher chances that the journalists who are doing that are likely to be arrested. I don't assume that all of a sudden in the US there was freedom of the media. There has been a journey. What has been the journey? What can we learn from that journey? Who advocated? What did they do? You cannot invent anything. Everything in this world has been invented. So one probably needs to learn from the other how they have done it so as to then build their communities.
Thank you. Brighton?
I think it's been quite an interesting learning curve for me being in the United States. And there are quite a number of examples I can cite about the similarities, the contrasts, and the differences between the African continent I'm coming from and the United States of America. But of course, it's also been exceedingly amazing learning about the different intersectionalities of issues around the media, and that also how that also transcends into how communities perceive the media in the United States and how communities back home perceive the media. So I have learned a lot about how best we can also improve our radio stations using state-of-the-art technology, which is extremely amazing, and now we can also realize that it's very important as media practitioners to be very open-minded to learning and be responsive to the needs of the community, because things keep evolving and changing every day. How we report, how we gather information, how we research keeps evolving. So how do we ensure that we create a steady balance and we tread carefully in this changing media environment? But I've also come to realize that there are quite a number of things that, like Tinay described, the United States can learn from Africa in the media fraternity, as well as in the civil, in the human rights fraternity, in terms of wage, payments, and the likes. Because I would like to cite the example around payments and wage between men and women. Like back home in my country, a man and a woman gets the same amount of money, the same amount of wage, or the same amount of pay. So realizing that it's the other side of the coin in the United States was another learning curve for me. But I would like to also reiterate the fact that the way institutions are strong in America is a very interesting learning curve for somebody like me who's coming from the African continent. How the executive has got implicit and explicit powers, how the legislature operates, and how the judiciary also operates, and how all these three bodies are able to share power and not overlap the other is exceedingly amazing. So in a nutshell, I must say it's been an exceedingly amazing time. And I must say I've had a spellbinding experience in the United States, and I wish to take back whatever I've learned to my community and speak hope in my community that we can do it.
If someone is sitting somewhere looking at America now and Tanzania in terms of media and media independence, well, we might find a lot of similarities at this point in time. In terms of the way I see President Trump on media and the way I see my president on media. But the differences are, in the US, the media can always, like, can get back to the president, can get back to, you know, whoever in terms of freedom to express themselves, but also freedom as a press. But in Tanzania, they have to censor, and I mean, self-censorship, before they broadcast, before they say anything. And even we expect the media to be on the front line in promoting even freedom of speech. But then usually it's clapping the hands, even if the what is being said is not to their advantage. And also I see some sort of, like in Tanzania, for the print, e-media and now digital media, there's some sort of disconnection. Because with the cybercrime law, for instance, who does it touch mostly? The digital media, the people who are owning platforms, you know. But with the print, a bit they feel they're a bit safe. So they didn't, like, for instance, when people were complaining about their cybercrime, they were like saying nothing. And we see now it's affecting a lot of people. So during this period, well, here in the US, I've also learned a lot, but more especially about building relationships. And I think this is also a missing link for people in the civil movement, or civil rights movement, or if people want to push agenda forward in terms of press freedom. And therefore it leaves power to only one person or one entity to control everything and everyone. Like in the US, although president can say a lot of things, but still other institutions are functioning in a way to say, can we stop here? Can we direct here? And if someone has a case, at least you know I can get justice in the court of law. But here, it's not very visible. So this is one of the things that I should also take home to ensure that people need to have some sort of concerted efforts in advocating for pressing issues that are in relation to human rights and press freedom.
Thanks to our Megan Pauly and the fellows from the Mandela Washington Fellowship at the University of Delaware this summer. We'll hear from more of the fellows next week on The Green. Visit our website, delawarepublic.org, for full bios of the Mandela Fellows, including those you did not hear from today. And that's a wrap on The Green for this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at delawarepublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, or on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast and Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. We'll be right back.